Chapter 20. In the Ghetto of Medvedchik. Medvedchik was a collecting point for Jews of the whole area. In this ghetto, in the centre of the central government, close to Treblinka, Sobibor, Belzec, Majdanek and Auschwitz, the Nazis put the Endlösung into effect. Here they could practice their sadistic methods as much as they wanted. It was like a gathering place for a slaughterhouse which was filled anew as soon as the old stock was depleted. On the average, there were several thousand people living in the ghetto. At this time there was no Judenrat, no administration, only a brutal Jewish police force which was known to cooperate with the Gestapo. There was no registration, no hygienic facilities, no fuel or heat, and no food. People lived on the reserves of their predecessors, if they found any, or they would smuggle, which usually entailed the involvement of the Jewish police. It was said that they would drink with the Polish police. Every few weeks people were deported from Medvedchik, usually to Treblinka. The first task for arriving Jews was therefore to build bunkers and underground hideouts. Thanks to these bunkers, some Jews were sometimes able to avoid deportations and were saved, at least temporarily, from Treblinka. Under these conditions, serious diseases increased. For example, my friend and relative Shlomo Nussbaum, who was barely 20 years old, athletic and normally healthy, contracted tuberculosis and died shortly thereafter because there was no medical treatment facilities in the ghetto. Many people envied him because he was spared the ordeal of Treblinka. To die within one's own four walls was a much sought-after privilege at this time. Of course I met my child in the ghetto. She and I were happy to see each other again, but I had to listen to the reproaches of her aunt. Naturally I tried to defend myself and explain why I had left and what my intentions were, but then I did not have much success. Although the child's condition had improved a little, she never recovered from her depression. Medvedchik was, for us, Sodom and Gomorrah. Everything there was more brutal and more violent than anywhere else. The Jewish police, including its agents and informers, distinguished itself by its brutality. This city, during and after a Judenaktion, reminded me of Bialik's book, City of Death. It was steeped in blood and in suffering. An Aktion against the Jews was for our persecutors the fulfillment of the Endlösung, according to the Wannsee resolutions. It was like hunting wild animals. The police were the beaters and the SS the hunters. Like animals in the woods, we Jews were chased out of our holes and hideouts into the open and then hunted like rabbits and foxes. This game was a pleasure for the members of the master race, who behaved like the wildest of beasts, living in the greatest of luxury and were well-fed and well-dressed. They were well-armed and demonstrated their strength and power by shooting the weak, defenseless, unarmed and broken men, women and children. The extent of their barbarity and sadism defies imagination. In addition to one's own suffering, the crying voices of the hunted men, women, and children, like the laughing and shouting of the murderers, frazzled our nerves. Each shot hit, if not physically, then morally, a Jewish soul. After each action, the ghetto looked like a battlefield. Everything lay on the streets, wooden blocks, iron bars, bottles, glasses, straw sacks, cans, toys, baby carriages, and mattresses. Here was a pool of blood, there a pool of milk, paint, or marmalade. One saw spilt flour, salt, clothes of all kinds, tallit, tefillin, books, shoes, hats, dolls, blankets, and wheelbarrows. Here lay a man's or a woman's corpse, there a dead cat or rat, and out of their minds with fear, people ran back and forth. Everything stank. Bricks were torn out of the buildings, stones out of the streets, blood, urine, excrement, and trash were everywhere. This was a hellish chaos, a total eclipse of humanity. Human dignity was trampled underfoot. Everywhere in the streets and gutters, torn and trampled books and pages abounded. Especially noticeable beside the yellow pages of the five books of the Torah were the oversized pages of the Gemara and Talmud commentaries, including the leather covers in which they were formerly bound. The typical pages of the Chumash and Talmud commentaries, in varying sizes, were highly respected by the Jews. They were regarded as a symbol of scholarship and treasured as family heirlooms, handed down from one generation to the next. When a page was worn out, it was buried like a human being, with care and respect. If a page fell to the ground, it was gently picked up and kissed. These books and commentaries, which were an early source of human ethics and an inspiration of many religions, were now, according to the Nazis, to become the cause of all evil? Was the Aryan world, especially the master race, to be freed of them? In the history of mankind, there have always been brutal men, murderers, and sadists. but never before has there been such an organized torture. Anyone who did not live through that period cannot imagine the reality and extent of the Nazi genocide. The perpetrators of this crime dehumanized themselves. For us, it started with the naive belief in goodness of humanity, its culture, and civilization. It ended in the death of 6 million Jewish men, women, and children, whose only crime was being born Jewish. After these Aktionen, one saw those who had managed to survive, crawling out of their hiding places, hungry, thirsty, bloody, with little of their human features recognizable. They emerged with deeply sunken eyes, full of apathy, but occasionally also full of spite and hope. That is exactly how the Nazis wanted us to become. I was also living in a ghetto, and despite my hidden Aryan papers, was convinced that I too would soon look like the others, unless a miracle occurred. After I had given up all hope of successfully completing my mission, and realized that there was no possibility of acquiring the forged papers for my Polish escort, I began looking for information about his fate. I heard that a friend of mine from Pajew had been arrested for possession of illegal documents, but he was set free through connections and was now living in the ghetto. I went to see him to hear the details of his stay in prison and perhaps get some information about friends we had in common. He told me that the prison population was almost exclusively Jewish. One day, however, a Pole from Warsaw was thrown into his cell. He had been caught with 60 Aryan identification papers and all the corresponding equipment for forging additional papers. The Nazis wanted to know who commissioned him. He said it was a small black Janek who had given him 1,000 zloty for bringing a bag from Warsaw to Majdziecik, in which he did not even bother looking. Janek was supposed to have entered the ghetto. I knew immediately who he meant, since all the dates and the story of the 100 zloty were also correct. I had to exercise great self-control so as not to show too much interest. I heard the rest of his story as from a great distance. He added that the Pole was tortured repeatedly because the Gestapo believed that he did not want to reveal his employer. In the evening, the Pole was led through the ghetto by the Gestapo and Jewish police in civilian clothes in the hope that he would recognize the little Janek. My friend also told me that the Pole was still in prison at the time of his own release. The interrogation and the search for Janek continued. I fell into a mood of resignation and deep despair. After having escaped from Agin with great luck, successfully playing cat and mouse with the murderers, and having lived as a relatively free man, I was again standing alone and abandoned, helpless and discouraged as a ghetto Jew in the waiting room to Treblinka. I had no one with whom I could discuss my situation. None of the persecuted here had the time or the patience for others. Each one fought his individual war against the strong and brutal military extermination apparatus which was set against each Jew with rigorous brutality and consistency. It was as if the fate and future of the master race depended on it. Together with the Chevra, I had tried and risked everything. Now, as a lonely loser, I had lost everything. My Chevra, my power, and my last possibility to resist. The thought of being sought here by the Gestapo and the Jewish police, and the possibility that at any moment I'd be caught, the torture that awaited me, the confrontation with my good, respectable Polish companion, how could I look him in the eye after having caused him to suffer so much? My main concern, however, was, would I be strong enough not to betray my Chevra? Would I withstand the torture, or would I die in shame as a traitor? In those days of discouragement, I considered it a punishment to still be alive. I regretted not having died anonymously with my family. Now I had the privilege of being broken first on a Gestapo torture table, with a name and as a known person. I remembered an old saying from my grandmother, "When God gives sores, he also provides the power to withstand them." And that was my hope. Despite my apathy, however, I knew that I had to hide or escape immediately, and since I could not escape, I decided to hide. I hid in the bunker of my cousin's house, lest I be recognized if the Gestapo and Jewish police searched the house. No one in the place was to know my whereabouts. Before I arrived, Leo and some boys had built an excellent bunker for 20 to 25 people. It was the secret of the house. The entrance was the most ingenious part of the bunker, an outhouse in the backyard, which could be reached quickly through an apartment window. It looked like any other lavatory with water and no sewage. It was intentionally kept disgustingly filthy. This filth was our guarantee and security. The cover could be opened by a trick in order to climb into a pipe which was supported by wooden beams. After 10 to 20 meters of pipe, one came to a room which was approximately 2 meters high and 2.5 to 3 meters in length and width. The room was also supported by beams. In the center of the room was a barrel of water which was covered by a wooden board, and this served as a table. There was also a bench with some blankets on which one could lie down. I spent 5 or 6 days in the bunker, and there I buried my dreams and hopes of emigrating to Palestine, reaching the partisans in the woods, rescuing little Sarah, or going to Warsaw to meet my chevra, and again seeing all that which I loved, treasured, and missed. I later received a terrible blow when I heard that the Gestapo, by means of the identification cards in my companion's bag, found the 4 young people in Suchowola, ordered a roll call of all workers, called the names of those who were present, and shot them on the spot. They had waited impatiently for those papers and saw them as their last hope for survival. Because of my unsuccessful mission, I felt that I was their gravedigger. Even today, that memory still weighs heavily upon me. That these 4 identification cards were issued exclusively by Moshe Gelman and without my knowledge was no consolation. Among those shot were Idel and Odessa Turkeltaub. I have unfortunately forgotten the names of the others. The hygienic conditions in the ghetto soon had terrible consequences. Small wonder that typhus suddenly developed. There was neither soap nor facilities for washing. Everyone in the house became infected except Leo. Although he cared for all the sick, he never contracted the disease. Even before it started, I was half-starved. Now, suddenly, we were 3 young men in one bed suffering from typhus. There was neither food nor medicine. Our Dr. Hershkovitz was a refugee from Czechoslovakia, and was probably still only a pre-med student. His effectiveness was limited to the possession of a thermometer, which always showed our temperature to be over 104 degrees. Without proper care, food, or liquids, we were starting to lose our hair and strength, and lay quite ill in our bed. More dead than alive, delirious with fever, we 3, each hardly 20 years old, fought for our lives. But we were at least safe from Aktionen and the Gestapo, who were still looking for me. The ghetto was given a respite. Signs reading, typhus epidemic, danger of infection, entrance prohibited, could be seen on windows and doors. The Gestapo stayed far away. Supposedly, 95% of the Jews in the ghetto were sick, but only 5% died, which is a miracle under such circumstances. On one of those days during my illness, as if through a misted glass, I recognized Tova Elfenbaum from the Chevra in front of me. My friends knew that my mission had failed. They wanted to help me and take me out of the ghetto. For this reason, Tovola had come from Warsaw. For this, she risked the death penalty. She saw my pathetic condition, talked to Leo, and stood at my bedside for a few minutes, since she could neither talk to me nor take me with her. The feeling of not being forgotten by my friends later instilled in me a new incentive to survive. At age 18, Tovola Elfenbaum belonged to the younger generation of the HaShomer HaTzair organization. Through the efforts of the Gelman brothers, she, along with Moshe Kaschenmacher and Yechiel Leuchter, came to us in Warsaw when they were about 18. Almost all of their parents and relatives had already been liquidated, but they wanted to survive and were prepared to sacrifice their young lives to attain that goal. The entire Chevra, especially Moshe, had only one aim, to defend themselves and to establish resistance. For that reason, they tried to get more friends out of the ghetto and bring them to Warsaw without regard to their own safety, even knowing that increasing the group meant a greater danger of being discovered. All these young people who were imbued with Jewish culture, a love of Zion, and were inspired with the idea of fighting against the Nazi murderers, all of them died nameless and without graves. I regained my strength gradually. After typhus, hunger was my major problem. Those around me also suffered from hunger. I was so weak that I could hardly stand and keep my balance. When I used a button, I broke into a cold sweat. In this condition, how was I going to find something to eat or work? But with each passing day, I grew stronger. There was only one place where one could always find employment, with the gendarmerie or the Schutzpolizei, or Mijerjek. The 30 or 40 Jews who worked for them were forced to do so, and their lives were in constant danger. A terror for all of us was a policeman of German-Czech origin, whom we called Der Schläger, the beater. He was a sadist who daily tortured and shot a few Jews at breakfast and lunch. Because of him, nobody wanted to work for the police. However, I volunteered. We had to march in lines to our place of employment, which was about 30 minutes away from the ghetto. There, we were given all kinds of dirty jobs. On the first or second day, an officer arrived with a defective lamp and asked who could repair it. I volunteered, satisfactorily completed the task, and then was given several similar jobs through which I attained a sort of special position. Although the work was paid for by the Judenrat, occasionally we were fortunate enough to find something to eat. Usually it was food which was thrown away and was not good enough for the chickens or geese. The officer provided me with work. One day he took me to the meat room, where all kinds of meats were stored for the police unit. He ordered me to perform some electrical work there and locked the iron door as he left. In the frigid rooms were vats full of bacon and meats of every kind. Ham and sausages hung from the ceiling. Almost starving and recently having recovered from typhus, I felt like someone dying of thirst in the desert who finds a spring and is not allowed to drink. My stomach rebelled, but I was afraid to even taste anything. I ate with my eyes, but it was like licking sugar through a window. It was a battle between hunger and fear. Which was stronger? Although my hunger increased, behind my fear was the question of life and survival. I was afraid to try anything, since I thought that everything must have been counted. I did not dare take anything, lest I might be caught at the control point. In both cases, an immediate death by shooting was the inevitable consequence. So I decided at first only to rearrange the ham and sides of bacon. It was possible that the meats had been counted, and that it was set as a trap for me. I did that for 2 days, changing from morning to lunch, and from lunch to evening. Nothing happened. On the third day, I ate my fill for the first time in 2 or 3 months. During the next few days, I ate once more, and in the evening smuggled 1 or 2 sides of bacon in my waistband into the ghetto. After that, I did not return to this job. The sides of bacon were my start capital and gave me new courage and motivation. As you see, I was still alive, and even full. After the typhus epidemic had run its course, the Deportation Aktionen continued in the usual manner. Some SS men in small groups carried out their own attacks in the ghetto. During one such midnight raid, I ran barefoot through the back of the house, wearing only my underwear, and hid with others on the tin roof of an adjoining house. It was extremely cold. The tin sparkled with frost. We had to lie down on the roof so as not to be discovered. Our bare feet and entire bodies stuck to the cold tin. Every time we moved, it felt as if our skin was part of the tin. At another time, out of fear for an already announced Aktion, I fled with a group of people to a forest 10 kilometers away. The woods were always considered a possible place of rescue, but many Jews lost their lives in attempting to contact the isolated groups of Russian partisans or others. Later, after approximately 1 year, with the changed war situation, it became easier to disappear in the woods and join the partisans. Only with weapons did one gain the respect of others in the forests, and that was one of our chief difficulties there. None of us knew how to handle a weapon. Upon arriving in the woods, we started to build an underground hiding place. Soon Polish foresters appeared, and without any reaction or movement, observed everything. From the looks on their faces, we soon realized that in digging a hideout, we were actually digging our own graves. Without exchanging a single word, the foresters watched us in quiet irony. Their faces revealed their intentions. Apparently, they could not decide whether to rob us themselves or to turn us over to the Gestapo for the usual bounty. In any case, what awaited us was clear. We therefore decided to leave the woods before it was too late. Disappointed and in despair, we returned to the Majicek ghetto.